And in any case, it's Joe Rogan's freedom to talk to anybody he wants, and it's my freedom not to listen.
Like 20%.
20%? Yeah, that content is getting the super government ban and maybe kinetic strikes on people that are hosting the content, yeah.
Blue Sky now, you know, where all the progressives are to compete with X. There's nobody there. I joined. I went over there. It's boring. I post just radical stuff just to see if anybody's even listening. And no, they're not. No one cares. So I'm like, okay, I'm back to X.
So I think we all agree, like, roughly on the principles. We just have to figure out, like, what is the actual defining line on it. But instead, we're talking about whether or not COVID vaccines, you know, make you magnetic, or what spike protein detoxer you need to buy in order to clear your system of the horrible mRNA spike vax particles or whatever.
Destiny, you're great. This is just so many good examples here.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first of a series of anti-debates on Kynos. Today, we'll be taking on the topic of truth, and specifically, to what extent does platforming dangerous ideas serve truth? So arguing for a greater extent, like, you know, let's get all ideas on the table, is Michael Shermer. Michael is a writer, historian of science, executive director of the Skeptic Society, and founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. Shermer was called by Neil deGrasse Tyson a beacon of reason in an ocean of irrationality. And he's about to publish a book called Truth, What It Is, How to Find It, and Why It Still Matters. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
And arguing that platforming dangerous ideas does not necessarily or inherently serve truth is Stephen Bunnell, aka Destiny. Stephen is a political commentator, a debater, and a streamer. He has millions of followers across platforms because he is willing to engage anyone on any topic in rigorous good faith conversation, and he is willing to upgrade his positions in the face of new information, which is a rare and precious thing in our online public discourse. So welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
And our facilitator today is Alexander Viner. He is an author, a journalist, and facilitator focused on bringing transformative ideas from the margins of culture into the mainstream. I'm going to hand it to you, Alexander, to take us away.
Thank you very much, Steph. And yeah, Michael and Stephen, thank you for doing this. This is going to be a very hopefully unusual style of debate. Certainly my hope is that we can enter some new territory, some new intellectual territory. We will start almost like a traditional debate where each of you will give your position on this question. But we have a bit of a twist because you're going to give a personal story first as to, you know, your feelings and your kind of how your perspective developed, and then get into the perspective itself. So first off, Destiny, if you could give us your story, your personal story, and then your position around this question. Again, to what extent does platforming dangerous ideas serve truth?
Yeah, so I grew up in a Catholic household. I went to a Catholic grade school, went to a Jesuit high school, and I would say probably around 15, 16 years old, I was kind of on the way to becoming an atheist. Obviously, as an atheist, I'm a little bit biased, but I would say that any person that is of reasonable and sound mind, when you start asking enough questions, you kind of inevitably start to tend towards or trend towards a more critical direction that makes it really hard to hold on to your spiritual beliefs, I would say, at least in any kind of like formal organized way. One thing, I guess, as part of the inevitable journey towards atheism in the late 2000s as a young man, I kind of started reading Ayn Rand. I was like a hardcore libertarian. I identified as an objectivist. And, you know, I remember campaigning for Ron Paul and everything else. And as part of this kind of like journey, I watched a show called Penn & Teller's Bullshit, which I hope most of you are familiar with, but I'm pretty sure I watched every episode of the first three seasons of this show. I loved it. It was an entertaining show. It fed me a lot of like interesting ideas, critical ways to look at the world. And then through Penn Jillette and listening to him speak, I found out that magicians had this reputation for being these like spiritual debunkers, going all the way back to Houdini. And, you know, as a person growing up, libertarian, free speech was a huge thing, watching, you know, Penn and Teller do their thing on their show. I started watching random videos on the internet. One guy I came across that I thought was really interesting was... I want to say Randy Fine. James Randy.
The amazing Randy.
Yeah. James Randy, who did I think the ultimate culmination of his show. He was a guy who used to be a magician, a stage magician, not real magic. And he also would kind of like go on in his career to debunking people. And I think it ultimately culminated in like a $1 million challenge where he would bring different spiritualists or psychics or telekinetic power users onto his show. And then he would do clever little things to kind of expose that, well, I don't think that this trick is actually authentic, or rather, I don't think your powers are authentic. I think it's a trick. I think probably one of the most famous videos was, I think James Heidrick was his name, where it was a guy who would use telekinetic powers to move pages and phone books around or pencils on desks or whatever. And Randy would, you know, pour some styrofoam around it and say, well, see if you can do it again. And the guy obviously can't because he's just blowing to kind of like trick the audience. And yeah, you know, watching this kind of stuff, I would say when I was younger, I say younger, but really all the way up to my mid late 20s, in my mind, this is like the ultimate version of freedom of speech. You have bad ideas, you've got anybody going on stage to show these bad ideas, and then you've got other people who are skeptical, and then they debunk those ideas. And I'm like, oh, well, this is cool. This is a system that works. I would say now, at the age of 37, after COVID, after doing politics, after doing debates, when I look back on things like that show, now one of the things I wonder is, what did I gain watching this? Like, was this an idea that needed to be debunked? Like, I think it was cool to watch it happen. I'm sure there was at least one person maybe whose mind was changed, but now I'm kind of thinking, like, did I really believe that telekinetic powers were a thing that somebody who was wise, who could think critically, who could do research, that they needed to invest their time into debunking that idea? How many hours in the day should I spend watching telekinetic powers, psychic powers, spiritual powers being debunked? And that's, yeah, I guess that'll kind of be the lead into where I'm at right now today when I try to think about, you know, what does it mean to have freedom of speech or to platform dangerous ideas or to fight against people who are propagating lies or misinformation?
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And I'm actually going to invite you to... well, actually, Steph, what do you think? Because this is part of our experiment. Should we go straight into the position, or do we want to mix it up a little bit? And
the idea, yeah, was to mix it up. I think it's nice to start with the personal story before getting into the meat.
Let's do that. So, yeah. So we'll invite Michael then, if you can give your personal story about around this topic.
And then we'll yeah, sure. Position. Happy to do so. Yeah, that was a fascinating account there. Destiny, a lot of overlap with myself. I wasn't raised in a religious home, but I became religious in high school. I was born again, evangelical Christian. I went to Pepperdine University to study theology and so on. So I took it all pretty seriously. And then I went off to graduate school and then became an atheist. And then I became sort of a born again atheist, going around knocking on people's doors, telling them I take back what I said earlier about God. And at Pepperdine, everybody was reading Atlas Shrugged, and I thought, what is that? I mean, this thing is a massive book. And I finally read it, and it's like, oh, my God, this is great stuff. So I went through, like you, my objectivist stage for a while and all that. For me, though, I took a turn more toward science and skepticism and rationality rather than more political issues or religion. And so what I'm interested in is really the truth. What should I believe about anything? And my background is, in the sciences, social sciences, and then the history of science. So I've kind of have a large, big picture perspective, you know, of how often we get it wrong. And so I start with the principle of fallibilism. We all might be wrong. And the Copernican principle that we're not special, that I'm not special, I might be wrong also. So to me, the importance of free speech is, you know, because you might be wrong. So you got to talk to other people. Anyway, in 1992, we founded Skeptic Magazine. Here's what it looks like. Each issue has a particular theme to it, like one on race and one on trans and one on crime and punishment. Every quarter, we take on some particular issue and we want to know what's the truth about it. And often we don't know what the truth is, so I have to publish multiple perspectives, and I actually seek out, like we did one on abortion. So I'm pro-choice, but, you know, I sought out and got somebody who's pro-life. I said, give us your best arguments. And she did, and it was great, you know, because some of those issues are not resolvable. They're not soluble in a scientific sense because they have so much gray area in between. When does life begin? Well, depends on how you define it. And, you know, pro-life people define it differently than pro-choice people. So just from the very beginning, you're going to get different perspectives on that. And that tells us something about the search for truth. And then finally, I write books in addition to publishing the magazine. The latest book is on this topic, truth, you know, what it is, how to find it, why it still matters. And so I'm still searching, and I think I'm just going to be searching until, you know, the lights are out, including on that particular topic, you know, where do I go when the lights go out? And the answer is, I don't know. And you don't either. Nobody knows if there's a life after. So, but in that case, I better make the best of this life. And that's what I've tried to do.
Brilliant. Thank you. I know, but I'm not telling anyone. So
that's just you got the secret. Okay. We'll publish it in Skeptic.
You'll have to wait for the entire end of the anti-debate to hear that one.
So thank you, Michael, for that. And so, Stephen, if you would like to give your position on the topic now.
Yeah, so I'm kind of taking this from a broader like freedom of speech perspective, because I feel like when we talk about platforming, you know, rough ideas or offensive ideas or ideas that some people wouldn't want platformed, ultimately we're having a discussion at the end of the day on freedom of speech. And then to start this off, I would say that whether we're aware of it or not, I think that most people have an instrumental view of things, such that there is a thing that exists, and this thing exists because it serves some other purpose. And I would argue that even truth, to some extent, fits the bill on that. So the reason why we gather truth, why we try to find out what's truthful, say through a process like science, is so that we can take that truth and then leverage it through a process called technology. And then through that process, we create things that enrich our lives. You can see this when we go out to gather truthful things. Usually we have some kind of end in mind. Medical research starts with the idea of making people healthier. Physics research starts with the idea of gaining a better understanding of the universe, and then this could manifest in so many technologies. Generally, our searches for truth aren't random. They're usually in a particular direction with us trying to gather some information that will hopefully enrich our lives in some way. Obviously, there's a trillion, quadrillion different ways you can analyze speech, but I'm kind of looking at three different prongs when I'm looking at what do you need to have a good free speech environment. The first prong that I have is you need to have an environment where people feel like they can speak freely, obviously. So this might be free from government laws saying you can't say a bad thing about a politician. This might be free from a social media platform that can ban you for any reason if they don't like what you say. This might be free from family or cultural influence where, you know, people will ostracize you if you say a particular thing. You need some general amount of freedom in these domains in order to feel like you can speak and have an idea be said. The second part is you have to have the ability for other people to hear you to speak. There are no private languages. You can't utter words into a wall and expect you've accomplished anything. The whole purpose of speech is to be heard by another mind. If nobody can hear or understand what you're saying, then there's really no point to you even speaking. And then the third prong is I think that you need a framework where you can hold people who are lying and people who are acting in bad faith accountable so that these people don't overwhelm your system and kind of like hijack it and use it for their own personal gain to the detriment of everybody else. I usually find that when you're looking at these prongs, different political groups will overemphasize different prongs. So liberals tend to overemphasize the first. Now, if you're having a conversation on law, obviously, we're usually talking about just the government banning freedom of speech. But, I've heard liberals say, well, as long as the government isn't banning, you know, a particular type of speech, it doesn't matter if every single social media platform deplatforms you, you still have your First Amendment right. And while that's strictly true, in practice, it's not really true. You don't really feel like you have much speech if literally nobody can hear you say anything. And then for the second prong, I think conservatives tend to overemphasize that, where conservatives seem to think that every single person should be unbanned on every single platform. And as long as you can hear every single thought and word and sound and everything at the same time, that now we have like a good freedom of speech environment. And sometimes I think that they over-index on that and they have no concept of any type of speech should be banned. And this is for a myriad of reasons that we might get into later. And then nobody really pays much attention to the third prong because I think it's a little bit scary and uncomfortable. The idea that somebody can censor some speech, or the idea that we need some framework by which there are certain people that just shouldn't be allowed to participate in a free speech environment. But I think that when you have any of these individual prongs that fail, any of the three prongs that fail, I think that your environment is basically completely and totally nullified for the purposes of having a free speech, good conversation. If you destroy the first prong and you have no free speech, then obviously you have a single authoritarian entity that can determine what is or isn't spoken about in the public discourse. And like, it's self-evident why that's bad. You don't want a single person to tell you what you can or cannot say for obvious reasons I don't really get into. On the second prong, without the ability to hear people speak, I mean, there's just no speech happening, right? One person talking to you is a conversation. Two people talking at you, you know, might be an outing with friends. 100 people in a room screaming at each other is not a free speech environment. Nobody knows what's being said. No ideas are being communicated. You know, it might as well be nobody speaking if there's 100 people speaking at the same time. And then the third prong, if you have no ability to hold liars accountable or to get rid of people who are just acting in pure and obvious bad faith, then I think you overwhelm any speech platform so much that there is no true, honest, good discourse happening anymore. And unfortunately, I think we're in the world right now where that third prong has kind of failed. I think that we've kind of spent, especially over the past... I have to remember how many years it's been for COVID. We're at six, seven years now, I guess, especially in like this kind of like COVID, post-COVID world. I feel like we have lost so many good conversations. I feel like we've lost so many, there's like these mines, these treasure troves of conversations we could have had about, COVID is obviously the most heated example. You know, did we open schools too late? Should we have ever closed the schools? What should lockdowns have looked like? We have had none of those conversations publicly. Instead, it's all focused on whether or not Anthony Fauci was making billions of dollars by telling us not to buy masks. You know, I think there's a super fascinating conversation to be had about vaccines. And, you know, to borrow from Alexander, I actually think, or is it Alexei? I don't know how you prefer your first name to be said, but I think that intuitively, I think a lot of us actually have more agreement there than not. I think that everybody would be for a mandated vaccine on a disease that was latent for 2 weeks and then killed you. I think everybody would say, okay, you need to be vaccinated against that. I'm not going to die. I don't think anybody would want a mandatory vaccine for a slight cold that you have to get every 2 weeks. So I think we all agree like roughly on the principles. We just have to figure out like what is the actual defining line on it. But instead, we're talking about whether or not COVID vaccines, you know, make you magnetic, or what spike protein detoxer you need to buy in order to clear your system of the horrible mRNA spike vax particles or whatever. And it's just, there are so many people that have an extractive relationship with our free speech environment where they come in, they sell sensationalist ideas, they make a ton of money doing it, and then there's no accountability for those people. So we spend all of our time from the smarter people either disengaging completely because they don't want to waste their time with the horrible conversations, or fighting against obvious misinformation from obvious bad faith actors who have no engagement or regard for the truth, who also have no accountability mechanisms, so they can just continue to lie with impunity over and over and over and over and over again. And I think that's a failed speech environment. You're keeping track of the time? What's my time at right now?
You're about on time for that.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I just want to make a final
yeah.
point.
So yeah, I guess in summary, like I would say that freedom of speech is an instrument. It's a tool that we use to arrive at better conclusions. It gives us a greater understanding of the world, and it gives us a direction to move towards, ideally to make life better for all of humanity. And when we don't have the ability to hear honest people making good conversation in a publicly accessible forum where anybody theoretically could participate, when we lose that, either through a lack of the freedom to speak, a lack of the ability to hear, or a lack of the ability to get rid of like bad faith actors, once we've lost that, the entire environment kind of collapses in on itself, and we have a facade of a free speech environment where bad faith actors have just hijacked the system to sell us, you know, entertainment masked as truth or news.
Great. Thank you for that, Destiny. And guys, I'm just going to switch the format here in Riverside. And Destiny, just to check it doesn't mess with your live stream. This is for the Instagram, because I can see it just needs a swap just to see. It should just be one person. So Michael, it'll be speaker view now. Michael, if you would like to give your position on the topic, please.
Yeah, happy to. Those are all good points, Destiny. I guess I would start by saying, Jennifer and Stephanie and Alexander, the idea of a anti-debate is great. You know, I've done dozens of debates in my career, and mostly I'm trying to win them. I'm not engaging with this other person, mostly theists talking about God, but other topics, to find out what I should believe about this, and maybe I'm wrong. I'm trying to win, and that's how debates are normally structured, like the Oxford Union debates and the Intelligence Squared open to debate people. They have the audience vote ahead of time what they believe, and then at the end you vote how they take a vote to see how many people were swayed by your position or the other person's position. And I've won all five of those that I've done, but I got no closer to the truth. The point was not the truth. The point was to win, and I like to win because I'm competitive. So I really like this idea. In fact, I've taken to wanting to do more in conversations than debates because they're far more constructive. Okay, now the problem with the resolution here, to what extent does platforming dangerous ideas serve the truth? Well, you identified it already. What constitutes a dangerous idea? So I wrote a book about this called Giving the Devil His Due, so I'm going to read the most famous case study of this Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in the famous 1919 case of Schenck versus the United States, in which he concluded that the most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. It is a question of proximity and degree. Okay, so what were these? What was this clear and present danger that the United States government had to protect us from? Who was this guy, Schenck versus the United States? Okay, well, Charles Schenck was the head of the Executive Committee of the Socialist Party of Philadelphia, who during the United States participation in the First World War objected to the draft, that is conscription. Because conscription, if you think about it, as he says, is a form of slavery. The government is taking control of you and your body for a period of time, and you have to go. And if you don't, you're a deserter and you go to prison. And so they printed flyers and handed them out to young men saying, basically, here, I'll just read one portion. A conscript is little better than a convict. He's deprived of his liberty and of his right to think and act as a free man. A conscripted citizen is forced to surrender his right as a citizen and become a subject. Okay? Now, you can debate that, but he has a good point, and he convinced not a few young men that they were not going to go into the draft. They didn't want to go over to Europe and risk being killed. All right? That seems like an all-American thing, but, you know, there's one of these conflict issues that we're talking about here. Should he be free to disperse flyers making that case? Of course, because one person's dangerous idea, like telling young men that the draft is a form of slavery, is another person's freedom. You know, freedom idea, right? Defense of freedom. And so basically my argument is based along those lines. The moment you set up a precedent that we're only going to ban the dangerous ideas, or more modern parlance, hate speech. Okay, we're in favor of free speech, but we just don't like the hate speech. Oh, yeah? Who's going to decide what's hate speech? You? Me? Are you and I going to form a committee? And then what criteria are used to censor certain speech? Ideas that I disagree with? Thoughts that differ from your thoughts? Then three, it's not just the right of the speaker to speak, but for listeners to listen. When colleges deplatform speakers or students succeed in silencing a speaker through the heckler's veto, the right of the audience to hear the speaker's ideas is violated. We might be completely right, but still learn something new in hearing what someone else has to say. We might be partially right and partially wrong, and by listening to other viewpoints, we stand corrected. We might be completely wrong, so hearing criticism and counterpoint gives us the opportunity to change our minds and improve our thinking. No one is infallible. In any case, whether right or wrong, by listening to the opinions of others, we have the opportunity to develop stronger arguments and build better facts for our positions. Okay, so that's, you know, kind of my summary of defense of free speech. Give some examples. Like in the 1990s, when I encountered the Holocaust deniers, I was just sort of nosing around for skeptic. What are some new controversy? Like, oh, here's these Holocaust deniers. They're on major television shows. And so I thought, okay, what are the rebuttals to their arguments? And so when I went to Holocaust historians, the response is, they're just a bunch of anti-Semites. Don't pay any attention to them. It's like, yeah, okay, that's the genetic fallacy that, you know, the origin of their ideas is what refutes it. But that's not the case. That's a fallacy. You know, maybe they are anti-Semites. How do I know? But even if they are, what's the response to that particular argument that they're making? Anyway, I made a list of like 20 different arguments that the Holocaust deniers made, and then we published them in Skeptic. Here's their argument. Here's the rebuttal. Here's the argument. Here's why they're wrong, and so forth. And that took quite a bit of work because most historians are not interested in refuting the arguments made by Holocaust deniers. Okay, same thing with creationists and their challenges to evolutionary theory, Darwin's theory. I saw not a few evolutionary biologists really get their hat handed to them by creationists in debates because they didn't know what was actually at stake. They didn't know what the arguments and the rebuttals were. So I think it's really important that we not just have the speech, but also informed rebuttals or how to prepare yourself for this. Now, that said, you don't have to platform everybody. I was teaching at, for example, at Chapman University when Milo Yiannopoulos appeared at UC Berkeley, and he was roundly shouted out and protests, and he wasn't allowed to give his talk. And I thought, you know, well, that would be interesting to have him come to Chapman, and we'll protect him and let him hear what he has to say. But as some of my colleagues pointed out, look, there's hundreds of people we could invite to come speak at our campus, and maybe we can invite six for the year. You know, every other month we'll bring in a big speaker. You know, why Milo Yiannopoulos, and why not somebody who actually has a highly regarded career, books, you know, ideas and so on that have been vetted. And even if they're controversial, at least we know this is a reliable person, whereas Milo Yiannopoulos is more like just an agitator and activist. And, you know, you can't platform everybody, so you do have to choose carefully. So there, I think the idea of expertise and trust in our institutions and all that, you know, makes a big difference. And then, you know, so pretty much all the issues that we deal with, like just pull some from the headlines, you know, what should I think about the ICE raids and the incidences in Minneapolis? Well, the only way to get at it is to look at, say, those videos from multiple perspectives. So if I go over to one site, you know, they go, you can clearly see here that she was trying to run over the ICE officer. And then you go over to the other site, looking at the exact same video, go, you can clearly see here that he intended to kill her, even though he shouldn't have. It's like we're looking at the same video. So how am I supposed to determine the truth of what actually happened? In this case, because it's ambiguous, you have to let multiple people speak at the same time and judge for yourself. Or other examples, you know, when Joe Rogan had on Robert Malone or Jay Bhattacharya during COVID, and people gave him a hard time about this. You know, these guys are fringe epidemiologists, they're fringe doctors, and you know, it's not right to platform them because those are dangerous ideas and it's going to make the pandemic worse. Well, it turns out they were at least partially right about some of the things they had to say. And in any case, it's Joe Rogan's freedom to talk to anybody he wants, and it's my freedom not to listen, or to listen and then go listen to somebody else to rebut him. And Joe, to his credit, has had other critics of those people on his show. And that's how it should work. Like in the case of Jay Bhattacharya, he wrote that great Barrington Declaration saying that closing the schools, closing businesses and beaches here in Santa Barbara, unbelievable. You know, there was a terrible idea, and it's going to cost us more than the risk of the pandemic. He was right. You know, so the only way that we know he's right is because we let him speak. We platformed him, and that's how it works. So that's my defense.
Great. Thank you both. So before we move into section two, we're just going to have a little bit of time for a combination of what would normally be called rebuttal, but I'm loath to use that word. But you know, what do you agree and disagree with in what you've just heard? And so, Destiny, if you'd like to maybe start us off from what Michael the position he just shared, what do you agree with first, and then what do you disagree with?
I'll start out by saying because I don't imagine Michael has gone through all of my content or any of my content. I hope he hasn't, because what a horrible world YouTube politics is. But what? Although I imagine the world of fighting religious people is probably not much more fun. This is a position that I have, like, I call it like 55% confidence on. Like, I'm like 55, 45. Like, I could be swayed from one end to the other. I recognize this is an incredibly difficult it's just there are so many complexities. It's a very careful balancing act that you're playing on both sides for this. And my reputation online is the guy who everybody calls a Nazi because I debate Nazis, or the guy who people call me a tanky or communist or whatever, because, you know, I do enjoy debating kind of these out there ideas. I've seen a lot of the issues that kind of stem from this. So I'll say on the first part, I would obviously agree, because I enjoy fighting a lot of these fringe and crazy ideas. I like sitting down and reading a full paper from start to finish and Wikipediaing and Googling all the little scientific terms and bringing on experts and trying to talk to them to get a comprehensive view of things. I enjoy that process. I don't think I would be able to enjoy that process in a world where those ideas were so heavily censored that, you know, you never saw them. So I have a lot of respect and appreciation for the environment we have in the United States. I like that people can say crazy, horrible, stupid stuff and the government doesn't, you know, fine you for it or arrest you or jail you for it, or at least it didn't before this administration. I don't know if that's true any longer, but traditionally in the United States, you could say crazy, offensive stuff and the government can't come after you for it. These are things that I greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate in the United States. The two criticisms or the two issues that I have that I think are going to be kind of like the foundational bedrock things that we'll either agree on, disagree on, or have different approaches to. Is the first thing is, it's this concept of when the government gets in the business of regulating speech, well, now you've got some decider that can tell you who is allowed to speak or what ideas are allowed to be platformed. And I challenge this by saying that I think that that already happens. The only difference is it's done on different levels. So right now in the podcasting world, what ideas are platformed or aren't platformed are kind of sort of left up to a couple of large podcasters, maybe Joe Rogan. For instance, if Joe Rogan decides that he wants to host a particular speaker, that speaker is now almost certainly going to be hosted by a ton of other podcast people that are going to want to pick him up. And when I look at people like the Dr. Robert Malone guy, I would consider this is a guy who is largely fraudulent. I think almost every claim that he made was wrong. A broken clock might be right twice a day, and I would consider him right maybe once a day. He might have been correct about some things, but it was only by chance. His epistemic approach to anything was deeply flawed. There are so many reasons why this person being platformed, I don't think benefited anybody. Yeah, there are things that I understand more about vaccines and immunology and diseases and everything else that I didn't before, but like, did I need to do all of that research to believe that spike proteins don't live in my heart forever, or that vaccines are worse for me than diseases? I don't know if that was even worth necessarily the time. Like, maybe there's something more interesting to debate or research. So all that to say, not to get on the Robert Malone example in particular, I think that there already is a gatekeeping that happens, but we kind of delude ourselves into thinking that as long as the government's not gatekeeping, then there's an equal opportunity for everybody, which is absolutely not true. And then the second kind of bedrock principle I have is I think that humans are not by default truth-seeking machines. And it's interesting to me because I feel like skeptical people fall into this, but skeptical people know more than anything else. You have to train your mind really hard to not fall into bad thought patterns. I think probably the most important class I ever took in my entire life, it was an AP Psych class in high school, and it was just learning how unbelievably unreliable my own brain is. I'm sure if you've been in a psych class, everybody's watched you have to watch like three people passing a ball back and forth, and then a guy in a giant gorilla suit walks across the screen, and you don't even realize it until the professor stops and then rewinds them. You're like, oh, geez. We've all seen, I'm sure, the video of the college kids, a robber comes in and steals something from the professor and leaves, and they're asked to give an eyewitness report, and nobody has any idea, you know, what the guy looked like. You get wildly different descriptions, and we're unreliable narratives of our own history. They're just thing after thing after thing. In order to stop, we've seen the ask line test or whatever, where you can see that group dynamics can pressure people into giving answers for things that aren't true. We've heard about Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment, where people put in different roles can act in crazy ways that they never would have imagined. We've seen Milgram's experiment, where people can torture other people as long as there's another person that they can defuse responsibility. You know, example after example after example. All this to say, people have this weird idea that if you put me in front of a multitude of different ideas or a ton of different information, I will pick the thing that's true. And in reality, I feel like psychology and history show us that people will just pick the thing that's the most comfortable for them. And that can be problematic if we're relying on people's inbuilt intuitive search for knowledge to guide us in any, you know, free speech environment that's fraught with bad actors. So I challenge that. Those are the two big things I challenge. So one is that there is already some gatekeeping that happens. And then two is to make people understand we're not by default truth-seeking machines. And to some extent, we need to be on guardrails to make sure that we're not just veering off into crazy territory just because it makes us feel good or satisfy some preconceived notion we have.
Great. Thank you Destiny for that. Michael, what do you agree with, disagree with in everything said so far from Destiny's position?
Yeah, those are all good points. I agree with some of that. Let's talk about this, holding liars accountable. Of course, most liars don't think that they're lying, right? I mean, I adopt Jefferson's perspective, let friends be wrong so that you can, get along and not fight about everything. But of course, said friends think you're wrong. They think I'm wrong. I think they're wrong. They think I'm wrong. I'm fond of saying no one in the history of the world's ever joined a cult. You know, they join a group that they think is going to be good. People that act on their beliefs, they're probably self-deceived at worst instead of they're intentionally deceiving. You know, the protesters on January 6th that marched down to the Capitol building, we know most of them actually believed it. You know, they told us, even the guys that went to prison, they said, yeah, I think the election was stolen. Even after they got out of prison, I still think the election was stolen, right? Because the boss said so, so they believed it. Or, the ICE protesters, they're told that the ICE agents are like the Gestapo. Trump is like Hitler. These are the Nazis. And they are disappearing our innocent citizens. Well, if you really believe that's exactly what's going on, of course you'd be outraged. Of course you'd go out there and scream and yell and blow whistles and maybe cross the line and get in the middle of the street, and then bad things can happen. Okay, so people act on their beliefs. Now, are they held accountable? Okay, let's talk about that for a minute, because Destiny has a good point there. Well, we already have laws in place about libel and slander. And, telling lies about somebody that then harms their reputation, they lose their job or whatever. You can sue them for that. And those things happen all the time. So there are standards that journalists, real journalists, have to meet. And places that have fact checkers and editors will be very careful about that. Before we publish this story about this guy who allegedly embezzled or he cheated on his wife or whatever it is, we better make sure that, we can defend this in court if we get sued. False advertising by companies, they can get sued by the federal government for that. So we have a lot of things in place, restrictions on speech. I cannot, if I happen to know the launch codes of our nuclear weapons, I can't just freely post those on my X account, right? So we have lots of restrictions already in place that most of us, I think, agree. Yeah, that seems reasonable. It's always in the sort of gray areas there. Gatekeeping, yeah, okay. So if we move off the page of what the government can do to restrict our speech and just go to private companies like X. So we know that before Elon bought Twitter, that from the Twitter files, that they were restricting people's speech. We know from the emails we can see amongst the employees that they were, for example, censoring Jay Bhattacharya's X account, Twitter account. Jay Bhattacharya, again, the co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration, cautioning the government not to close schools and so forth too early or too long. And anyway, had we not known that the government was doing that, after Elon bought it, wow. So there was some gatekeeping going on there by the government through a private corporation. So, even private corporations, when they restrict speech, they're not always innocent in this, right? Now Elon lets everybody on there. Okay. Even the crazy people like Alex Jones and some of these anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers, I can't stand it. I really wish they weren't spewing this bullshit, but they are. And my argument would be, let them go ahead. This is my opportunity to debunk them, and I'm going to do that. And, that's the way to do it. I have a big piece coming out about Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson as the new, new Holocaust deniers. Because I know this, I wrote a whole book about these people and David Irving in the 90s. I've heard all of this before. I'm just asking questions. And we call that JAQing, jacking off. That's what they're doing. I'm not saying the Holocaust just didn't happen. I'm just wondering how they could have cremated that many bodies per day at Auschwitz-Birkenau, at Crema too. And when we're told that this, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, I have the answer to that. Should X say, you can't say that on our platform? I wish they wouldn't. And in any case, this is a sign of our times, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, they don't need X. They have millions and millions of followers. Why? I don't know. I just wish I understood why it is people gravitate to that. Maybe it's part of the economic model, but it is disturbing. Okay, last comment on the default to truth. This is a big debate in cognitive psychology circles. Do we default to truth? Do we just kind of believe whatever people tell us? There's some truth to that, because who has time to fact check everything anybody says? We don't. So we have to offload onto institutions and experts and journalists and newspapers and magazines what we hear. I mean, I've never been to Ukraine. How do I know what's actually going on there? I have to trust what the newspaper, well, maybe I don't trust them all, so I read the Wall Street Journal, I read the New York Times, I watch Fox News, and I watch CNN and MS Now. You know, I just try to get multiple sources. Otherwise, you know, I may be deceived, but I kind of have to do some trust in this, or else, you know, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. Now, that said, I don't think people are as gullible as we think we are. Like Destiny in the some of the examples you gave, like conformity, like you show a group of people three lines and then you have a matching line. And so they pick whatever, if the person, the actual subject, is down the line from the other people that have picked the line that they think matches, which is the incorrect one, you know, yes, they do tend to conform. But if you have one person earlier in the lineup picking the correct answer, then our subject is more likely to pick the correct one rather than conform to the majority. So there are ways to tweak that. Even Milgram's famous shock experiments. If the subject that was being shocked, they're not really shocked, is actually in the room with them and they can see it, they're far less likely to conform, to obey authority. Or if you actually have to take the person's hand and put it down on a shock plate to make them obey authority, they're less likely to obey authority. So there are ways to get people to be more rational. The gorilla, you know, the guy in the gorilla suit. If you get everybody focused on one particular thing, count the passes. But if you don't do that, if you say count the number of passes by the subjects, but also look out for other things, they're more likely to see the gorilla. You know, and this is why, you know, like in jury selection and so on, Elizabeth Loftus's research, you mentioned this, Destiny, of, you know, you show a video of a little crime being committed and you ask people what they saw, like what color was the guy's hat? He wasn't even wearing a hat and everybody saw a hat. Right. But lawyers know about this. And so they counter it. And so in the law, the way we get to the truth is you have these adversarial, like a debate, you have adversarial sources fighting each other, making the case for their clients on each side, or he's guilty, he's innocent. And then the judge or the jury is the peer review. And so, but the only way to do that is that they could really be free to make their case. And then hopefully we get to the truth of that. Anyway, that's my response to that. Sorry for the coughing.
No problem. Thank you very much, both of you. So, we're going to go into the next phase now, and I don't know if anyone's seen the, you know, Tarantino movie From Dusk Till Dawn, where the film starts in one way and then suddenly turns into a vampire movie. It's kind of what's happening here in the sense that we're going into a different phase, which is now unlike a debate. What we've just done is, you know, useful. It's useful as a way of establishing perspective, and you both did a great job and eloquently explaining that perspective. What we're going to do now is we're going to drill into specific examples around this question. However, we're going to do something else first, because what I noticed listening to you both is that while you have differences, of course, in perspective around this issue, there was some that I wrote down two words: trust and betrayal. And I'm curious, before we do anything else, I would like to invite you, if we for a moment just set aside the energy of yes, but, and okay, yes, but, you know, you said this, and, you know, that's where our minds go often with this. I'm curious to hear, and for you each to hear, what your relationship is with trust in society, let's say, because my sense was that you both feel mistrustful that people are equipped to some degree, equipped to truth seek well, but you have different responses to it. So, and I'm paraphrasing here, and I know I'm simplifying, but Michael, because of that, there's a sense I got that, well, let the only way to be sure that we don't have some kind of power structure telling us what is a dangerous idea or not is to open it all up. And Destiny, from you, I had the sense that you know, there is equally, we're creating environments that are just toxic for free speech in the first place, and we can't really trust each other in those environments as well. But rather than talking about the nature of trust, I wondered if you would both just speak a little bit to what is your relationship to trusting society, trusting that we live in a society where we can, trust each other to actually come to truth in some way. So maybe, Destiny, what comes up for you with that question?
So when I'm looking at anything in life, this especially applies to economics and then finance and then branches out to what we're talking about, online platforms, everything else, I just try to look at where the incentives are. So I like, Shermer brought up the example of January 6th, which I think is actually a really great example. If you were to tell me that of all the people marching to the Capitol, that 99% of those people genuinely believed that the election was stolen, I would probably agree with you. Both my parents are MAGA. I think they both probably thought the election was stolen. I think, unfortunately, they're very earnest in their beliefs. I think that they genuinely, truly believe that. I had a debate with Owen Schroyer, and I challenged him on stage because I said the first person to break the window to get into the Capitol was a Proud Boy. It was Dominic Pizzola. And I challenged him $5,000 on that, and he refused to accept the bet on stage because he knew that he was lying. So I think there's a difference between your kind of average layman that is navigating media environments and other pariahs or extractors of value that are navigating these environments. And I think it's good. I think it's important to make that distinction. I think that backing up, I guess, if you look at the way the human mind works, I think our best ability as people, or one of our best abilities, is we have this ability to recognize and fit patterns exceedingly well. And if you try to go back to the environments where humans survived, you know, in our early existence, if you have three hunters standing shoulder to shoulder and a bush shakes in front of them, two of them are going to run away because they're going to assume it's a predator. And one guy might have a genuine, curious, scientifically inquirious mind, and he wants to go up and investigate, and he'll get eaten by a lion. It's not very good to be curious in that perspective. I don't think curiosity is rewarded all the time, at least in environments that humans come from. So there's a lot of ways that we overfit data, things like racism or misogyny, or there are so many mathematical things. You have like base rate fallacy errors, and people think that you need a sample size of 100,000 to reach a high confidence interval. And there are so many different things you have to learn and then unlearn about yourself and your own intuitions if you want to get into data or numbers, that I just don't think the average person has ever spent the time doing this. Now, I don't think that the average person should have to. I think that's, it would be ridiculous to expect them to, but it would also be ridiculous to expect an average person to be able to sit in front of somebody who we might know is trying to push a lie to them and expect them to be able to discern that lie, and then expect them to be able to discern two people that are debating that lie when the layman just has no concept or no base level of experience to even understand what the two people are saying. So yeah, my trust in society, like, I would say it's low, but that sounds bad. Most people just don't have the time. We're so specialized today. Like, think about these losers from 5,000 years ago that they called like polymaths and stuff because, you know, they figured out that you can use a variable for math, or they figured out that, you know, whatever, a triangle has three sides. It's like, wow, this guy's a genius. Like, today, you know, every research paper has 100 different co-authors because you need so much specialization to know so much about whatever the areas of research are, that, yeah, I just think it's very, very, very difficult for the average person to keep up in that environment without more careful guardrails in place.
Awesome, thank you. So, Michael, what about you? What's your relationship to trust in society and trust in general?
Yeah, those are all great examples, Destiny. This is such a perfect example of what I've been saying, that this kind of critical thinking needs to be taught really in high school, and not just an AP class. Everybody, maybe in middle school, should learn all the stuff that you learned, so that when you go out into the world and you encounter these claims, you could be like Penn and Teller, the Amazing Randy, with your bullshit detector, because it's absolutely the case that it's everywhere. You mentioned, pattern seeking. That's my idea of what I call patternicity, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in random noise. And the argument I've made, I think that you're echoing, is, you know, imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? So this is a signal detection problem. And it's just costlier to make one kind of error than the other kind of error. So if you assume the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator and turns out it's just the wind, that's a false positive, but no harm. But if you make the other error, you know, you assume it's just the wind and it's a dangerous predator, that's a false negative. Your lunch, you get a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool early. So we are the descendants of those who tend to be, you know, a little more risk averse and cautious and make one kind of error than the other kind of error. Now, again, most of us don't have time to fact check everything, right? So on January 6th, how do I know that the election wasn't stolen? Maybe it was. I never went to any of those polling places where you saw the kind of grainy of videos of a truck pulling up in the back of that place in Arizona with the boxes that maybe ballots, maybe not, who knows? And, you know, you see these claims being made. You know, I don't have time. I have a job and a life. I don't have time to go to Arizona and check out, you know, what was actually going on there. But there are people who do, like the Justice Department, you know. So when Attorney General Bill Barr said, and he's a lifelong Republican and voted for Trump twice, said, you know, we looked into it and we examined all these particular cases and we found no fraud. To me, that's it. I don't have to worry about this anymore. I don't have to go fact check it myself. I trust the institution working. I know some MAGA people then threw Bill Barr under the bus for that. But hey, you know, what's your option? You know, do your own research. Do you really have time to go check out every single voting precinct and go to every person that worked there? And so, of course not, right? So trust is just super vital. You know, back to your objectivist economic policy destiny, you know, no country could be an objectivist free market without the rule of law and private property and some kind of overarching structure to protect people's property rights and freedoms and so on, because people will cheat if they can. That's why low trust countries are mostly impoverished. They have next to no free trade. It's hard to start your own business and so on because they have no property rights. They don't have laws. They don't have courts to enforce laws for contracts and so on. So the idea of trusting institutions is everything. If we don't have that, then you really don't even have a viable democracy or free market economic system. So that's, you know, to me, it's everything. It has been hit pretty hard in the last 6 years because of the stuff that came out during COVID that I've mentioned. I think we can build it back. We have to. You know, Trump is such a divisive character about everything. Yeah, I mean, you can love him and you can call balls and strikes with Trump and say, I like this, I don't like that. But whatever he says, it's so divisive for both the left and the right that, you know, I'm not sure it's restoring trust in all our institutions is going to happen in this administration, even if he's just a great president. And mostly what he does is great. It's still because of the environment. It's going to be a few years before we get back to where we used to be, I think.
Thank you both. So I want to go one level deeper before we go on to some specific examples around free speech and censorship. And I'm going to challenge you not to mention science at all in this answers, because what I'm curious about is you've both dedicated an enormous amount of energy and time to calling out different forms of bullshit, right? That has been fundamental, it seems, to both of your lives and careers. And I'm curious why, of all the things you could be doing, why did you each focus on this? Why are you having debates and arguments? Why does it matter so much that we do move towards some sense of truth? And again, just to you, you know, forgetting that you don't have to prove any points or back it up, because this is just your perspective. So Destiny, like, why does it matter?
I feel like there are certain topics that you learn about, and then like once you've become, I guess the term is like woke on a thing, you kind of see it everywhere and it can drive you crazy. So it might be like a feminist thing where you see how women are treated in some respect. It might be a maybe an atheist versus religion thing. I don't know. For me, I played a lot of poker kind of after high school for a bit, and just learning kind of like the math and the odds behind poker, I would look at slot machines and I would wonder, like, how could you ever pull the lever on a slot machine? Every single time you pull, you're basically losing some small amount of money over a long volume of pulls. I just don't understand how anybody can do this. And I feel like when it comes to reasoning your way through things, once you've kind of learned that process, it's just very frustrating to watch other people fall into very predictable pitfalls. where if you spend enough time navigating these environments, there are just some things that you see where it's just so obvious once you see it. If somebody wants to make the argument to me that X is incredibly bad for some environment, and you know, you're just watching them give a speech and they go, we know that X is bad. And we know that X is bad because if you look at the data from 22 to 32 year olds and you look at what happens on Fridays, you can see that X is bad. When I hear a thing like that, I'm like, oh, the opposite is obviously true. Because no, there is no world where you cherry pick a stat so hard. Just by doing that, you've demonstrated that you're familiar with the literature. You know that your point is wrong. And now you've had to like razor focus on an individual single stat to try to give you a lead here, right? That all of that is so immediately communicated by that type of cherry picking. And then when I hear other people say things, oh, well, but I heard that this guy said that X was bad because of blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, what do you think they mean when they say that? I mean, of course. Or people who do kind of like this, these different attribution errors where, you know, I'll hear it said so often that the, you know, media has a bad incentive to do this. And people will have, this is the thing that drives me the craziest, actually. And I've like a metronome, I go back and forth on this. Right now I'm in the camp of like, people intuitively are actually quite smart. Because sometimes I'm like, oh, God, people are so dumb. But there's a thing politically that shuts your brain off sometimes when it comes to certain things. And then when that political barrier is gone, all of a sudden the human rational mind emerges once again. And, you know, sometimes people will look at a thing and they will be so deeply skeptical of it in an intelligent and surprising way. And then you say, oh, well, actually, I told you that was Team A, it's Team B. Then they're like, oh, actually, I don't think that's a big deal at all. And it's like, no, okay, well, the thought process is there. I guess for a real world example of this, to kind of bring this whole point home, there was a brief period in time where I was like, I'm gonna start betting people on some of these political predictions that they're making, because these are just so wild. Like, if you're really that confident that this guy has a 99% chance to win the election, then you should be willing to give me, you know, 100-to-1 odds, basically, that this guy is gonna win, right? I bet $10 and you give me $10,000 or whatever, or $1,000, you know, if I'm correct and you're wrong. And what I found when I started to do this, and I did it for a brief period of time, this frustrated me so much. My expectation was one of two things would happen. Either people would accept the bets and I'd make a lot of money, or I would just arbitrage it on Polymarket or ever make money, or people would make up some excuse and say, well, I don't want to bet you, whatever, you're posturing. But instead, the third thing happened, which is where as soon as I say something, oh, you think there's a 99% chance that this will happen? Okay, well, then let's bet. You know, give me 99-to-1 odds and let's go. Instead, they were like, well, it could be that this could happen, or maybe this might happen, or maybe this, and it's like, okay, so all of this is in your mind. You have the thoughts, you have the information there, but something is blocking it from coming out. But when I attach like a bet to it, now all of a sudden the reasonable mind turns on. So I guess it's just one of those things where like when you see like certain patterns, or you see certain things, you spend a lot of time dealing with it, it just drives you so crazy to see other people fall into that misstep. And some people are, I'm like a corrector, obnoxious, discreet, like we need to fix this thing kind of person. And I like arguing and I have the demeanor for it. So that's probably why I'm so invested in it, I would guess. Yeah.
Thank you. Brilliant. And Michael, if you could give a couple minutes on this, and then I've got a few scenarios for you guys.
Great. Destiny, you're great. This is just so many good examples here. Yeah, that's like those studies you see, you know, reported in the news, you know, like this rate of cancer has gone up 100% due to this chemical. And it's like, and you look it up and it's like, it went from 1 per 100,000 to 2 per 100,000. Oh, so I don't actually have to worry about this, right? Yeah. So those are very deceptive. I like your betting markets idea. I've taken to doing that too. Some of my more progressive friends are, you know, telling me there's not going to be an election. This is the last election we've ever had. There won't be another one. Okay. I'll bet you $1,000 there's another election in 2026 and one in 2028. Well, I'm not saying it's not going to actually happen. What I'm saying is that then they start, you know, twisting. It's like, oh, okay. That's what I do kind of like the principle of behind Polymarket. Although I was just reading something about where the guy who correctly predicted the day that the abduction of Maduro in Venezuela, like down to the hour, would happen, and he won, I don't know, like $400,000 in an hour by getting that right, and then his account suddenly disappeared. Okay, so there's something. He's an insider. I don't know what's going on there. There's something about that. But in principle, I like Philip Tetlock, the social scientist, wrote the book Super Forecasters. By making people put money up, it focuses them to think rationally about forecasting the future and holds their feet to the flame. Most pundits on TV or newspapers, op-ed authors, you know, they make all sorts of predictions, but no one ever calls them out when they're wrong. Well, if you bet money and you lose money, okay. So I bet I've had a $1,000 bet for years about alien disclosures coming any day now. I say it's not coming. Aliens are not here. And finally, Avi Loeb at Harvard took me up on my bet. So we have it's $1,000. And by December 31st, 2030, if the aliens aren't here, I win. Right. So, you know, there's specific criteria, I think, is a good way to get it. Now, for me personally, back to your original question, I just don't want to be wrong about things that I believe. And I have been wrong. I mean, I mentioned I really believed in God. I was a born again evangelical Christian. And then I decided, you know, I don't think I believe that anymore. I think I was wrong about that. And I've changed my mind about, like, gun control. You know, I was super libertarian about that. Now I think there needs to be some gun control measures. I'm pro-choice, but I think the pro-life people do have some good arguments. In other words, when I look into things in detail, I realize, you know, my thinking on this is not very deep. I better rethink this. Like Destiny, I was a big Ayn Rand objectivist fan. You know, then I started reading more economics and economic books, taking the great courses on economics. It's like, okay, you know, this needs to be modified. I was wrong about this and this and this. Now I, you know, believe something different. So for me, consuming content of stuff that either I don't believe or I disagree with is the only way I'm going to course correct, because I've been wrong enough that I don't want to continue being wrong about a particular subject going forward. And on the biggest question of all, you know, is there a God? What happens after we die? And I'm happy to be wrong. I don't think we're going anywhere. I don't think there's a God. I don't think there's an afterlife. I think, you know, when my time is up, that's it. Lights out. But I'd be happy to be surprised, I think, if I'm not in the wrong place. If I'm in the dark place, I'll be there with my friends Christopher Hitchens and Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould and Isaac Asimov and all the Bertrand Russell and all the other great atheists and so on. But we'll see. Anyway, that's my answer.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both. Okay, we're going to shift into some scenarios. And it'll be a little bit faster in the sense I'm going to ask you to give a kind of 2 or 3 minute off the cuff, what would you do in this? It's related, of course, to our central question. And as you're listening to your to the other person, I would invite you to see if you can, what I call, instead of steel manning, be in a position where you think of clay manning, where you're thinking, okay, what's the strongest part of that argument for me? And also, having now heard each other a little bit deeper of where you're coming from, why you have the perspectives you have, see if you can even allow that to change your perspective a bit. Not immediately jumping into, well, actually, here's what I think, but see if you can kind of tune into the person just a little bit more. The first scenario I want to give is, let's imagine that there is a kind of social contagion spreading online, particularly among sort of 17 to 20-year-olds. So some of them are adults, technically, but their prefrontal cortexes are still forming. So legally adults, they can do what they want, but this is a suicide contagion, right? So there is, if you imagine what I would argue was, to an extent, a social contagion around gender-affirming care, this is much more widespread. It's you don't know a kid who's not either looking at content to do a suicide. There's many suicides happening. What do you do in that situation? So, Destiny, what do you think would be a sensible response in that situation?
First, I would see how they vote. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. what are we allowed to ask more questions about this? Sure. Or because sure. The first question would be the how they get exposed to this,
and then online.
Is it online? Like they're like adult only, like dark web stuff, or is it like on YouTube?
It's everywhere. It's on Instagram. It's on YouTube. It's you know.
And then is this a style of content that is can I conceive of any other value of it? So like, is this all coming from somebody who discovered a cool way to make nuclear reactor watches and people are just using the content to now kill themselves? Or is it literally just videos on how to kill yourself? Like, that's it.
It's videos on that, and maybe the deeper philosophy of why one should be allowed to, right? Let's say there's many different expressions of it, but the key thing is there's a dangerous idea, the most dangerous idea perhaps, and it's spreading in many different ways.
Okay. And then in terms of magnitude, this is affecting a serious number. It's not like 20 kids. It's like hundreds or thousands, or
like
tens
20%.
Of thousands.
It's like 20%.
20%? Yeah, that content is getting the super government ban and maybe kinetic strikes on people that are hosting the content. Yeah.
Okay, great. So, Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, well, because they're minors, that's a different thing. We already agree that the government should restrict minors from, let's say, driving, drinking, smoking, getting a tattoo without parental consent, going into the military, and so on. We have all kinds of restrictions to protect them because they're not able to make those kinds of decisions. So when the trans social contagion thing took off, I don't know, about 8, 10 years ago, where it became cool to be, you know, the other sex or other gender rather than just goth or something harmless. Now we're talking about actual physical harm, permanently changing, altering their bodies when they're unable to make an adult-like decision, being encouraged by their teachers or the school nurses or their, more commonly, their Facebook friends. And the suicide instance, and parenthetically, so most European countries, in the UK especially now, are banning all that gender-affirming care for minors. And the United States will take longer to get there because it's a state-by-state thing. So, but we'll get there with lawsuits. As for the suicide thing, I think a lawsuit is going to settle this. There was that teenage boy who committed suicide. I think it was through his Facebook. It might have been Gemini and Google. Now I'm forgetting. But they have all the exchange with the AI that this boy went through, where the AI is basically talking to him in how to do it. You know, and it's like, well, should I use a rope? Well, a rope's okay, but try this, you know, or whatever. I tried that. It didn't work. Well, try this, you know, and I'm not sure I should do it. Oh, no, you should do it, you know. And the parents are now suing that company. I'm sorry, I forget if it was Facebook or Google, but that's gonna settle a lot of that. Again, because they're unable to make adult decisions, you know, adult consequences like death or being sterilized or never having a normal sex life again, which is what's happening to these kids, then that matters. So I think some of that will play out on social media, where the social media platforms will have to legally restrict and you know, censor ideas that are harmful to minors.
So Michael, and then I'll come back to you, Destiny, but what about if it was, let's say it's 40-year-olds, it's 10% of 40-year-olds, and it's the same kind of situation.
Or just say like 18 and older, 18 to 22, instead of 17.
Yeah, okay, well,
so they are, technically they can vote. All these people can vote.
Yes,
right?
Yes, okay, I know. If somebody wants to do that, why is it any of my business? I tend to go with that. That's kind of the libertarian position. Although, you know, somebody that wants to, you know, like euthanasia, you know, I'm feeling sad today. I think I'll take my life. Maybe there should be some, an adult, I mean, maybe there should be some restrictions on that. I guess I would have to concede that point. You know, in the same way, I've always been not in favor of prostitution, to decriminalize prostitution. What business is it of mine if consenting adults want to exchange money for sex? None of my business. Yeah, but it's usually women that get the short end of that business. And so don't we have some obligation to protect women from being abused by drug pushers, by, you know, powerful men and so on? Maybe. I could see some point there.
Destiny, how about you? How much would it shift, let's say, even from 20-year-olds to 40-year-olds, and let's put the percentage down a bit to 10%?
From 20-year-olds to, I mean, 10%, this is a massive number. Any whole percentage point that's causing people to kill themselves is going to be a pretty massive number that needs to, something like violent, I would say, needs to happen in response to that. One of the, this is the thing I've been kind of talking about recently. One of the challenging things with some hypotheticals and why they seem so difficult to answer, and I think even Schirmer is getting at this, is we, in our minds, whether we're aware of it or not, there's like an ontology to a human being. There are things that every human being wants to do, wants to achieve, ideas that we have in common. And there's sometimes there'll be like a hypothetical and it challenges our preconceived notion of something, not because, in my mind, it poses a very difficult question, but rather because it fundamentally alters some foundational ontological belief about the category, and then it challenges you to consider how you would apply standards to the category, when in reality it might change completely because now the category has changed. A vegan example I've given sometimes, people argue with me, they're like, what if there was a group of human beings that could never reciprocate moral value? You know, do you think it would be okay to kill these human beings? And your mind is like, well, I would never want to just kill human beings. That sounds really wrong and bad. But also in your mind, you don't consider this. A human being is not a thing that would be incapable of reciprocating moral value. You know, that would just be inconceivable. So you've changed the category so much that whatever new standard I might apply to this doesn't really apply to the whole. And I would say that the same here. So all of this to say that when you're asking me about a thing that's causing 10% of people to kill themselves, in my mind, a rational, reasonable, and when I say rational, I don't mean some, you know, nerd with glasses who's taken all the philosophy classes. I just mean like a normal human being that can evaluate their own health and safety in the environment around them. If there's something that's causing 10% of these people to kill themselves, then there's something that is egregiously or fundamentally wrong with that particular thing that needs like a significant correction or something to address it. So that was a really wordy, but yeah. Because there's no way the category of human being is not a category of thing that 10% of them will kill themselves if exposed to some content. So there must be something really, really, really wrong with that content, yeah.
Thank you for that. So, Steph, I saw your eyes light up a second ago. I'm wondering if you want to dive in.
Sure. Yeah, I'm going to throw two things onto the table that might help kind of like distinguish your positions even further. One is just this question of, could it be that the extent to which platforming dangerous ideas serves truth depends on the circumstances, right? In some contexts, we might say more speech might be a remedy for bad speech, but in outrage-fueled echo chambers, you know, sometimes more speech just leads to more outrage, or in this case, more suicide. So I'd be curious what Michael would say about the platforms and the algorithms and what, you know, what content is being amplified and how that affects the extent to which, you know, dangerous ideas actually do serve truth. And then the second, I'm just going to throw something else onto the table too, and that is just this question of whether truth is kind of like the ultimate value that we're even after. You know, we see circumstances in which truth exists in tension with other values. The famous example of, if Nazis knock on your door, do you tell them that Anne Frank is hiding inside? You know, and in different wisdom traditions have different ways of kind of acknowledging that. For example, the three transcendentals, goodness, truth, beauty. So like, are we always and only and exclusively after truth, or does truth exist in tension with other values in ways that would affect, you know, our desire to platform dangerous ideas?
Can I add a quick thing on that? Because I'd be curious to hear Michael Shermer talk about this. Just on the vein of that question, I'm curious, two questions paired. Is X a platform today that has more or less freedom of speech than it did 3 or 4 years ago? And then the second question is, do you think X is a better platform today or a worse platform today than it was 3 or 4 years ago? Kind of on the back of Stephanie's questions, yeah.
Okay, well, I guess on that, I think it's better, Destiny, but it also has a lot more downsides. Again, you know, it's platforming the Alex Joneses and all these lunatic and kooks out there promoting dangerous ideas. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, there's, I guess, a trade-off there. So, Stephanie, you mentioned that, you know, the Nazi comes to your door and asks if you're hiding Anne Frank, and you are. Should you lie? Yes, you should lie. Okay. So, you know, what we have here is a conflict between deontological ethics, Kant's categorical imperative. You know, it's always wrong to lie, with the utilitarian or consequentialist ethics that, you know, the greater good for the greatest good for the greatest number, and so on. These cannot be resolved ultimately where one is right and the other is wrong. It depends on the context. You know, the famous trolley problem where, you know, the train is hurtling down the tracks about to kill the five workers, and you can throw the switch and kill one worker. Do you do it? Almost everybody goes, well, yeah, of course, you know, say kill the one to save the five. But if you're in a waiting room at a hospital and there's five dying patients and they come out and take you and say, we're going to sacrifice you and harvest your organs to save the five patients, you're not going to be vibing that. And no one will. No one wants to live in a society where that could happen. You know, so we're constantly you know, going back and forth between these deontological and consequentialist ethics. That's part of the, it'll never be resolved because it depends on the context, to your point, Stephanie. Now, on the social media platforms, let me clayman Destiny's argument here, which I think is good.
Nice.
That there's something called the Pareto distribution or power law distributions, famous examples where, you know, like 1% of musicians make 99% of the music sales, you know, 5% of athletes make 95% of the contract money for salaries, and, you know, 1% of authors sell 99% of books, and so on. Well, in the podcasting world, that, you know, there's a Pareto distribution there. Like, you know, I don't know, maybe the top 10 or top 100 podcasts, they have like 99% of the market. Joe Rogan himself, you know, he's probably a Pareto distribution of, you know, 80-20 by himself. And that seems to be the case with social media. You know, I thought for a while that, you know, the correction to the abuses on Twitter were just other social, just other platforms where you have microblogging or whatever they call that. And that has not happened. And I don't think it can happen. You know, like I've tried some of the other platforms that came up. I joined them. I went over there. I posted. Nothing happens because no one's there. And so everybody knows that no one's there. And everybody knows that everyone knows that no one's over there. So they all just stick with X, right? And I think that's the way it is with Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. There's, you know, maybe there'll be a new platform that I can't think of that's different. But if you want, like Blue Sky now, you know, where all the progressives are, to compete with X, there's nobody there. I joined. I went over there. It's boring. And I post just radical stuff just to see if anybody's even listening. And no, they're not. No one cares. So I'm like, okay, I'm back to X. So my idea of a kind of a free market solution, let the marketplace of ideas, I don't think it can work with the way the economy is structured and the way these things happen in the real world.
Destiny, any thoughts on that? Anything you wanted that brought up for you? We've got about 10 minutes left or so. We want to make sure we get into some final points or statements, but there's, I want to just open that up.
I mean, I would say that more structured areas are better than less structured areas. I think there's something to be said for the fact that when liberals or lefties or progressives tried to make their own space, it was Blue Sky, which is a pretty sterile, boring platform without as much engagement. And when conservatives tried to make their own platforms, we got Gab and Parler, which to some extent was used by Proud Boys to coordinate infiltrations into the Capitol and other terrorist or white nationalist groups. And all of them are the most hateful, disgusting, terrible places ever. And they fail in about a year or two. I think that speaks sometimes to the difference in sides there. I would also say that, like, it's interesting when we talk about like the difference between Blue Sky and X here for the interest that we have in the platform. It really comes from the audience size of the platform. X didn't get big as a platform because it was a free speech radical platform where I can see a Mexican, a Sudanese guy, and an incel all doing Hitler Nazi salutes in some Miami nightclub outside or whatever. Like, I don't think this is why X became popular, why Twitter became popular. It became popular because there are a lot of users that enjoyed the features of the site. When it was more heavily moderated, that's where the huge user base came from. And Elon inherited that. And then I would argue the platform is significantly degraded now compared to where it used to be, at least in the political section. None of these, for all of the kind of fantasizing about the ultimate unbridled free speech platforms people have, none of them, as far as I'm aware, have ever been wildly successful ever. Like, it's only been the converting of a platform to something with more free speech after it's been more restrictive. Do you even see these things have a chance to survive? Like, X in its current state, if made into a new platform, would never have made it. Actually, Elon might have even tried to start his own social media platform called X before he bought Twitter. I could be wrong on that. But like Facebook and Twitter and all these other huge platforms obviously have a lot of moderated content and, you know, we're the most wildly successful platforms, yeah. But
so just before we go into these to some closing statements and reflections, there's something unresolved, I think, between you guys, which is that Michael, when you began your opening statement, you were talking about, you both talked a lot about context, that context matters for truth seeking very much, right? So I think there's an agreement there. But Michael, in your opening statement, the sense was there's no real way to, who's going to define the context? Me, you, the government? So because there is no way to define that context satisfactorily, you know, a free marketplace of ideas. Destiny, you know, you've talked about, you know, different types of intervention, military action at one point. So who decides the context? Who has the legitimacy to decide the context of where ideas are explored? So, I mean, yeah, who, maybe Michael, you go first and then Destiny, I'd be curious your thoughts on that.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay. So back to where I originally argued that, you know, we, all of us, the consumers, decide what the context, appropriate context is for speech, and we just have it out. But, you know, as we've seen with some of the exceptions, like the social contagion on suicides, euthanasia, gender affirming care, and so on. Yeah, obviously there's some exceptions there. There's a place, as I mentioned, economically for a strong government to enforce the laws of contracts and have a strong police and private protection of private property and constitutional rights and so forth. I mean, that's the whole point of the Bill of Rights. As Madison said, you know, we don't want to have a tyranny of the majority where 51% say we can enslave blacks and kill Jews, then we're going to do that. No, we're not going to do that. Doesn't matter what the majority thinks. So obviously there's already tons of restrictions from the top that even a good libertarian would agree. Yeah, you know, we should all drive on the right side of the road and we should enforce that. Absolutely. Or else it's, you know, you're going to have, you know, chaos. So short of being an anarcho-capitalist, which I'm not, you know, where there's no government, you know, I think, you know, we're already in the business of restricting human speech, behavior in many ways. I guess the question then is, you know, everyone, each instant has to be, you know, debated in the context of its consequences.
Great. And Destiny, how about you? Who gets to decide that context, or how do you see that working?
There's a very controversial movie that some people have very strong opinions on. It's called Sunshine. It was a 2007, like, sci-fi into horror movie, and a lot of people don't like the twist in the middle. Regardless of whether you like or dislike this movie, it has one of my favorite lines of all time. Basically, there's a bunch of people that are trained on the spaceship. They have to go and launch a nuke into the sun to make the sun start burning again or whatever. But at one point, they have a decision on whether they should divert their ship to pick up another bomb or go right to the sun, and they have to weigh the probability of whether it's worth the risk or not. And one of the characters on the ship says, okay, well, here's what we're going to do, everybody. We're going to take a vote, and however we vote, that's how we're going to figure things out. And I think one of the psychologists on board intervenes, and he says, we're not going to take a vote on this. We're a group of highly trained scientists, mathematicians, theoretical physicists. We're going to sit down and we're going to figure out what the best answer is. And that line is so interesting to me because in every other area of life, you would never just throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. If a friend was asking you, hey, I really don't know how to build a table, what would you recommend? You would never tell this friend, like, well, there's a room with 1,000 people screaming how to build tables, go in there. You would recommend, like, the best woodworker. Or if a friend was like, I think I have cancer, you know, where should I go? And if you're not Scott Adams, hopefully you go to an actual real doctor to get treatment for your cancer, for a person who's, like, gone through tons of intensive medical training to give you advice and guidance and treatment on how to train on how to treat your cancer. And there are so many every area in life when it matters, we recognize that, like, expertise and gatekeeping and specialized knowledge is, like, foundationally one of the most important things in terms of trusting, just because everything in society is so specialized, right? We're not 100 men tribes where one day I might be basket weaving and the next day, God forbid, I'm hunting cheetahs, right? That just doesn't happen in society anymore. And I think that we have to recognize, that particular thing is really important. And then when we look at our social media platforms, we have to recognize that just screaming into the void is not enough. We have to create some framework or guidance system to make sure that we are, by virtue of that system, working towards some true or good thing. The name was brought up in here, and we had a pre-show conversation about this, and I thought it was interesting that a couple names were brought up. I don't remember what the other one was, but Michael brought up the David Irving guy. Irving was a very popular publisher of books that was renowned as being a good scholar. He had hundreds of footnotes, thousands of footnotes through all of his works. He could speak German. He went through the archives. He did all this work. And he was widely regarded as a very intelligent, successful historian studying World War II German history. And it wasn't until he was put through the ringer on a very stringent court case where I think it might have been Christopher Evans, I think was the American or British historian, where they went through
Richard Evans,
where they went through line by line by line, and he couldn't obfuscate, he couldn't allude to a billion other footnotes, and he had to answer very specific questions. It was like, oh my God, this guy it's insane how little his footnotes are justifying what he's saying. It's insane how unjustified the majority of his arguments are. And even earlier we alluded to kind of the court process. The court process is nothing like the X process, right? You can't have, you know, 1,000 jurors in a courtroom where you can, like, there are very stringent rules of evidence. There's a process and a procedure. Only one person can speak at a time. Only one person can answer questions. There's rules about what questions you can or cannot answer. And yeah, I just think that I like a lot of the concepts related to freedom of speech. I dislike a lot of concepts related to authoritarians. I wouldn't want this administration to, you know, have the reins on who could speak or who couldn't speak. But I think we have to recognize there has to be some process that we engage in, because just everybody screaming into the abyss just doesn't seem to be working, in my opinion.
Great. Thank you both. So look, we're almost out of time. I wanted to give just a little bit of time, maybe a minute each or so, just to invite you to reflect on what are you leaving with today? You know, what have you noticed? Has anything, you know, is your curiosity spiked in some way from your I'm not going to say opponent, from the other person in the anti-debate, your other anti-debater. So maybe, Michael, you could start.
Yeah, I would just echo what Destiny just said in his final statement there. I agree. You know, we have to have some rules of evidence and conversation and exchange in order to get to the truth, and that just a total open free market, everybody screaming, that's not the best way to get there. So leaving aside the what do you mean by dangerous or whatever, I mean, in the case of David Irving's court case, what Richard Evans and his graduate students who went through every single thing Irving ever wrote was they showed a pattern of distortion where he said, for example, that all historians make errors, but the errors are random. In the case of Irving, the errors were not errors. They were all in one particular direction to exonerate Hitler and the Nazis and so forth. And so, you know, there the rules of exchange in a court room served to show us what the truth is about what we really know about the Holocaust and what, you know, Irving knew but distorted intentionally, clearly. And that was it. End of story. And he's washed up. He spent, $6 million on that case of his own money. He's broke. He's out of it. No one will publish him anymore because of that. So, you know, I think that's a good example.
Great. And Destiny, just what are you leaving with? What has Michael sparked in you?
I mean, I imagine me and Michael, I think by virtue of doing especially atheist versus religious debates and then anything related to skeptical stuff, I mean, if you have a magazine and the topic is race, then certainly you've dove into a ton of incredibly touchy subject matter material. So I'm sure both of us have probably thought about, I would hope, both sides of this argument a great deal. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm already kind of like, this is a very straddly position I have. I'm like 55, 45 on, we need some kind of like more regulation. I think that the thing that just bothers me the most right now is the outcome right now of where we're at is just so bad. I feel like scientific literacy and trust in our institutions and like the selective skepticism that people are having, I think is like at an all-time low. And I feel like right now, and I know now I'm old enough to have seen this, and I'm sure people older than me have seen this even more and more, and maybe I'm falling into the trap that everybody falls into where it's like it's worse than it's ever been. I do feel like there is a unique thing that exists right now called the internet that has the ability to take so much information and feed us things that make us feel good in a way that has never quite existed before. It is such a frictionless environment that I worry that our minds are not adapted for that, much the same that we don't have natural defenses against becoming obese because, wow, you're never going to have an abundance of food. And here we are now with an abundance of TikTok shorts and Instagram reels. And I feel like our minds are just as susceptible to that fattening as our bodies are.
Yes. Thank you very much, both. And, you know, just to add my two cents to that last point, you know, in my book, The Bigger Picture, I make, you know, I spend a chapter on the way in which the internet is like a psychedelic drug. And I think that also could be a topic of a whole other debate. You know, do the same rules apply around truth seeking when everyone is effectively in an altered state on this, where the truth seeking is happening? But I don't want to open a whole new piece. Thank you very much. And, you know, I think what I'm leaving with is a sense that the German poet Rilke said, you know, if you want to find the answers, you have to live the question. And I think that's my sense at the end here is a kind of a 90 minutes of you know, living the question in a sense. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you. And thank you, Steph. I'm going to hand over back to you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you both, Michael and Stephen. Congratulations on an anti-debate in which I think we all won. Thank you, Alexander and Kainos, for hosting. I also want to thank Common Era for supporting the creation of the anti-debate. If you'd like to learn more about it or use it or remix it for yourself, you can go to anti-debate.org. And I guess just as a parting invitation, I just invite all of us to use our different perspectives on our most important issues, not to further divide us, but to see those issues with greater complexity. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having us.